It's the Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. Once again, here's Patrick.
And once again to you too, Shirley. Good morning. And don't call me Shirley. Well, it's August 24th. Generally would be the dog days of summer here in Texas, but I was just telling Andrew Goss, we've had 10 days of rain. It's a miracle, Andrew Goss, when it rains in Texas in August. Just a miracle. Yeah, it's kind of fun, and I've actually had some cool temperatures. Going to be back up mid-90s today for a few more days, but man, broke that 100-degree spell. And this is the Real World of Money. Andrew Goss is a currency historian. We've known Andrew for about, 25 years or so, my goodness. And he has two books, Secret World of Money, Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. And he's here every Wednesday, and we talk about all things geopolitical, financial, how money works, what it is, how to save, how not to save, how to invest, how not to invest, and kind of keep an eye on the boys, the people that make money by making money. I've always liked that. They make money by making money. Oh, they make money by making money.
The old-fashioned way.
The old-fashioned way. We go down the basement and print it up. We had a gentleman on the show yesterday, Andrew, from Australia, about five PhDs, and his specialty is modeling, about to put out a book, and quite a bit of research he and his wife over the last 5 years. And he can prove that the model that the scientists have been using for the global warming idea is
slightly flawed.
Slightly flawed. They left out one component. You know, with math, right? If you leave out one line or one number, it doesn't work. And they left out something. It was something to the effect of when this thing heats up, and then you have to do one factor into it. And it took him a long time to figure out what they left out because he didn't believe it. And so he says we're actually going into a global cooling beginning in 2017. Not a lot, you know, 1 or 2 degrees, which is a lot.
Yeah,
which is a lot. And that's where we're going, 2017. So the whole global warming thing probably is a scam. I mean, he sounded pretty credible, you know, the way he the way he explained it. Yeah. So this could have been just, I don't know if this was a government conspiracy thing, or could have been
Waste a good crisis.
Yeah, never waste a good crisis. Exactly. Maybe they just latched onto it, you know. Al Gore latched onto it and said, oh, wait, we could do something with this. Or he could have, who knows.
It is the Hegelian dialectic. You know, this this nasty, nasty carbon, 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 very nasty. What should we do? We should cap it and tax it.
Cap it and tax it.
And then we set up a whole secondary market for tax credits relating to carbon, carbon tax credits. And boy, you're at the, you know, creation of that thing. You can make yourself quite a bit of money.
I've been kind of thinking about, and we have a little bit of tape from Carl Icahn. If you don't know Carl, ladies and gentlemen, he's like, he's one of the big dogs, isn't he, Andrew? He is like a billionaire.
Yeah, they named a stadium after him in New York City on Roosevelt Island. So,
really?
Yeah.
What was the name?
Carl Icahn Stadium.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And they did that because?
Because he donated, you know, a couple of bucks, enough to get a stadium named after himself.
I see.
Probably enough to build the doggone thing.
Yeah. Well, he's a very, very rich fellow, and he's got a hedge fund, I guess. Is that right? He's got a hedge fund?
Yeah. Yeah. The whole city's full of very, very rich folks. I think the median income in Manhattan to live here is $104,000. So you're either rich or you move.
Well, so he was talking about this this encroachment of government and big corporations, right? Mm-hmm. Which you've told us about forever.
Fascism.
Yeah. That's really the definition of fascism, isn't it?
It is. The merger of the government with the corporate state. It's what our those radical professors of the 60s used to warn us about. The rise of the corporate state, where corporations in and of themselves assume the power of government, or subsume the power of government, however you want to put it. But they essentially, you know, the drug companies use the FDA as their police force and so forth, just like that.
Yeah. And so I kind of was going on and on about the EPA and some really strict rules they put on these small guys.
Right.
And he's investors in those, so he's got a dog in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And how they're just totally benefiting the big guys.
Right. Well, that's their job. I mean, you didn't think it was like to protect the environment, did you?
Well, I mean,
if they wanted to protect the environment, they wouldn't let all these Chinese goods that are polluting the environment be imported into the United States.
But Andrew Goss, is it really that cut and dried? I mean, is this just the way it's? I don't know.
Listen, if they make a widget in Beijing and pollute the air, pollute the water, and abuse the workers, wouldn't it make good moral sense to say, you can't sell that here? I mean, we get all up in arms about, you know, fair trade coffee and blood diamonds and so forth. So,
blood diamonds.
Yes. We can't have those diamonds because those are manufactured or mined using slave labor. So we're not buying those diamonds. And that coffee is not fair trade. So you don't let the farmers make any money. So we're not going to buy that coffee. Why on earth would it be any different for everything else? I'm just beside myself on this point.
I'm beside myself.
Because we undergo such severe and strict regulation here in the United States. Like, this is the no smoking section, and every other country gets to smoke. So I don't know how we're going to protect ourselves.
This is enough. Well, one of the other reasons I talked about this. Oh, Donald Trump, he says Clinton Foundation is one of the most corrupt enterprises in political history.
Duh.
And because after the latest donor revelations, did you see that list?
Yeah, I had that list early. I think it's like of the 165
right.
private parties right. that she met with, 85 or so were donors to the foundation.
Big donors, too.
Yeah, but, you know, if you got all the rich people in the world in one room and then all of the political leaders in one room, you'd find that a lot of them are in both rooms. That's the argument that the left is giving, that these people just happen to be Clinton Foundation donors because they're very rich or they're very powerful.
Boy, it sure looks like, I mean, just from the cheap seats that this lady was doing a lot of silly things. I guess all politicians do, though. We just can't.
Well, they do.
Yeah, her,
influence peddling.
Influence peddling.
She's just the most blatant about it.
She just right out there, doesn't she?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The forming of this foundation was pretty ballsy, and you know the mechanism surrounding it. But the argument of why? How does she benefit? How is that benefiting her? It's a charity that's helping poor children. How is that benefiting her? And the figures will show that just 14% of the money that they raise is actually used for charity. The other 85% is used for salaries to people who also happen to help out her campaign. So it's like she's paying her campaign staff from the foundation while at the same time giving them a tiny paycheck from the campaign. So it does benefit her, benefits her greatly.
So this is, I don't know, in the mainstream media, because I don't do TV, Andrew has... Is this whole foundation thing out there pretty
big?
Yeah,
I must say.
Is it?
I said yesterday when I turned on the evening news, and, you know, there's the CNN, CNBC, Fox, Fox News, et cetera. And for the most part, just every channel was about Clinton and her foundation.
Really? Yeah. So they're all
over
it.
I said,
huh?
Donald Trump must be jealous. Huh. He's got no press. All summer you would turn from channel to channel. It'd be Trump said, Trump said, Trump said, and now it's Hillary did, and Hillary did, and Hillary did. So
you wonder why they would do it, because the boys are pretty much...
They can't ignore it.
Yeah, really, it's just too big of a story.
Yeah, it's like that other story that broke about the guy that stabbed five people, and you know, while yelling Allah Akbar, or whatever the heck they yell.
Ali Ali Akbar.
Yeah, in Virginia. Yeah. And, you know, you didn't see it anywhere. It wasn't. I was just waiting for it to appear on one of the news stations. And then finally, about 11:30 last night, it caught a little blurb. And then it's gone again. So they decide what they want to report on. And they decide what they don't want to report on. And if you think it's independent news, then I have that that quote by Edward, I think Swinton was his name, the managing editor of the New York Times when he retired. He had a few too many scotches at his retirement dinner and, you know, laughed about, an independent press. Please, if we printed what we wanted to print, we'd be looking for jobs in the morning.
Do you think middle America, modern America, most Americans, what would your term be, understand the financial implications of this election?
No, I don't think they do. They clearly don't. And if you get in a cost cutter like Donald Trump, we've already discussed in the past how government spending makes up a third of GDP.
That's just amazing. A third of GDP. So isn't GDP, what, $17
trillion? Something on that order. Yeah.
So $5-6 trillion?
Of it is government spending.
Wow.
Yes. Pentagon spending, EPA spending, you know, spending everywhere. Spending health, education, and welfare, social security, just spending. Government spending is a third of GDP.
That's counting, though, the ancillary spending that goes along with it, right?
Sure.
Okay, so, in other words, you need to bomb someplace into oblivion. That then you're also counting buying a bomb. You got to move the bomb.
Okay. You got to, you know, store the bomb, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And if you're building a road, you got to buy the road stuff.
And then you got to go in the UN and then put that there's a bomb in it's. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. And then got to draw a picture of the bomb.
Well, that costs money,
too. That costs money. Okay.
So all of this spending, if you're Donald Trump and your thought is, okay, I'm going to slash government spending, whether it's wasteful or not, whether it's useful or not, is almost irrelevant. Once you slash it, let's say you're going to cut it by a third. So you're going to cut it by a third. That's going to cut GDP by 4 points. Suddenly, the economists are measuring a recession. Because the government
spending. Sure, look what Donald Trump has done now. Boy.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you cut slash taxes. So in the beginning, now you're going to reduce revenue into the treasury. Although you'll probably stimulate growth, you might get an extra percent in domestic growth. So the thinking is that if Donald Trump becomes president, we'll probably have a recession. It'll be, as I described it, bad.
Bad.
But if Hillary Clinton becomes president, then the situation will be worse because she will not slash government spending. In fact, I think she'll unleash a stimulus program coupled with higher corporate taxes and higher taxes on the rich, which will cause both corporations and the rich to move to another tax base.
Even more so than today.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, of course. The higher you make those taxes, the more people. When I gave my seminars in my 20s, I'd say, at what point do you call it slavery? Some people say the current tax system, I think then it was, you know, maybe 17% of your income is slavery. And some people wouldn't really call it slavery until 30%. And, you know, and then at 50%, a lot more people would call it slavery. And the higher you raise that confiscation, the more people will call it slavery and decide that they're going to escape. So as you raise the number, so you raise the number of productive entities, both people and corporations, that will simply pack their bags and leave, move to another a less taxing authority.
888-663-6386, email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com, Bloomberg. So Carl Icahn is like Donald's friend, kind of sort of friend.
Yes.
And he did turn him down to be on the staff, but that maybe he'll change his mind if Donald wins. But Bloomberg, pretty good interview, asked Mr. Icahn if he thinks Mr. Trump can win. Listen.
I want to really believe that Donald has a shot to win.
And you don't?
I do believe it. I do believe it. And maybe I shouldn't be saying it on Bloomberg, but I will say it, that I do believe that Donald has a great shot if he sticks to the positives, not so much to the negatives. Meaning, if he just talks about the economy and what I'm saying and tells the worker in those swing states, hey, look, Hillary Clinton's making all these promises. I mean, I'm going to give you broadband for everybody. I'm going to do tunnels and bridges and all that. Where's she going to get the money? You've got a divided Congress and gridlock. She's not going to get the money, so she can promise anything. And to some extent, you could say Donald could promise it, too. But the one thing you know Donald can deliver is he can change the regulatory agencies as president. He doesn't need Congress. You got to look at things you don't need Congress for. He doesn't need them about immigration. And by the way, these are the things he could deliver. And that's what he's got to stick to. But
I have to presume that you're offering him this advice. You and he saw each other this past weekend. Did you not tell him?
Well, this weekend it was pretty quick. I mean, I came in, left. But I do talk to him. And I do, and I am going to keep talking to him about it. And I want, and he knows this too, that he's, look, I think Donald is great when he speaks about these things. I think his economic message two Mondays ago was terrific. And if he sticks to that, he's going to win. But, people are telling him, hey, you're down in the polls because forget all this, you know, negativity and arguments, and even negativity where it is factual, you do. And so that's one reason I won't do a pack that's negative against Hillary Clinton. I'll do a pack that's positive about Donald Trump and his economic, beliefs. And this is where you're asking, and maybe I'm saying too much. I think Donald's great. I think he'd be a great president. I believe it. A lot of my friends don't. You know, a lot of my friends are mad at me for this. But I believe it, and I believe he would do it. He is exactly what this country needs. But what he has to do is get that economic message across instead of just, you know, talking glibly about issues that really, you know, don't mean a hell.
Don't mean a hell.
Yeah. No, that's my advice as well, man. Yeah. I wouldn't say the word Hillary. I wouldn't bring up Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. I would talk nothing but economic growth and the opportunities there for.
Yeah, I agree, boy. If I was on the...
You would just stick on that message. Don't get baited into any arguments or fights. Focus on the economics of it all. It's the economy, stupid, right?
Well, people vote their pocketbook.
You know, talk about your tax cuts. Talk about your slashing government spending. Be prepared to defend your arguments and stay away from all of the salacious National Enquirer nonsense. In fact, he has many good surrogates. He can just let them talk about Hillary's health and Hillary's lying and Hillary's emails and, you know, all the bad things that Hillary
does. Let somebody else do it.
Exactly.
And then if he doesn't do it, probably the media may do it anyway.
That's right.
You know, let them do it, man.
Stay off that message entirely and just focus on what you're going to do, how you're going to eliminate the income tax on every family making less than $50,000, how you're going to slash tax rates across the board, how you're going to draw companies back to the United States by reducing the corporate tax rate. And all of these things will resonate with the American people if you just tell it often. Every single campaign stop, that should be his pitch.
Just do it.
Yep.
Okay, it is about 18 minutes or so after the hour. This is Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, and the Real World of Money. Let's do a quick little break here, and then we're going to get to some of your emails. And we have a lot of time, so emails, bring them on. Anything at all that you want to talk about regarding money, geopolitics, and how it's all inextricably tied together with Andrew Goss, some of your personal things that you're thinking about with investing or gold and silver stuff, whatever, markets, 401ks, Andrew talks about those things, whatever, right here. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Good morning, August 24.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Andrew Goss and the Real World of Money. So I guess just in general, market-wise, you think folks are going to be staying more on the sidelines into the election so they kind of gauge what they think their future is and, you know, whatever, yeah. Stocks, bonds, or whatever.
Yep, yeah, a lot of sideline.
They're going to kind of hang out a bit.
Right.
I'm hanging out.
Yeah, a lot of folks are. If you look at the H41 release, you'll see that the banks themselves drew down $66 billion from their reserves last week.
What does that mean?
Well, they had $2.4 trillion on deposit at the Fed. This is the money that has come to them through the bond buying programs, etc. And rather than reinvest it by loaning it to people and so forth, they just parked it at the Fed as excess reserves. and the Fed paid him a very minor interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last week, they drew down $66 billion, and I'm waiting for the figures today after the show. And in the last year, they've drawn down $200 billion from that reserve stash. So presumably this money is being deployed in other areas, probably in the bond buying purchases that are making the dollar as strong as it is today.
Oh, buying treasuries.
Yes.
Buying treasuries. And they're also buying their own stock.
Correct. Yeah, and they're buying, just about everything. If you look across the board, you'll see that the deployment of capital in these financial instruments, with the thought, again, some advanced knowledge, I'm sure, that the dollar is going to gain a little bit of strength here between now and the election.
But there, to Icahn's point, and you're going to hear some more, and the reason that his company is massively short, he's just, wow. This is, if you look at the charts and what his company is doing, his billions, he's very short. But he was saying on this tape that the banks are not putting money into
investments
into building, into
that's right.
equipment
they have,
or whatever.
They have $2,328 billion parked at the Federal Reserve. Again, as we spoke about last program, I don't know if this is some sort of collusion between the Fed and the member banks where it's almost an agreement. Look, if we buy all these mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds from you, and then you turn around and just put that money right back into circulation, it's going to cause inflation. So do us a favor and leave it here at the Fed and draw it down slowly. And this has the effect of delaying the monetary stimulus that the Fed created. Enough so that I think they could take their fingers off. They could take their hands off and say, okay, look, it's not us. We're not doing anything. And if you look at the Fed's H4-1 again and number of treasuries purchased, you'll see that they still did purchase $15 billion worth of treasuries last week, but that for the year, they've actually reduced their pile of treasury debt by $5 billion. So,
Icahn says, I think the markets are literally at very high levels because of zero interest rates.
Right.
And if you really look at it, the dollar is pretty strong right now, which is going to hurt international earnings.
Right.
The S&P, they live on international earnings. So
they
let's
do.
See if I understand that.
Coke and Pepsi.
Yeah, so the dollar is strong and their international earnings are down because
the dollar is strong.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Explain that to me.
When you convert
like a golden retriever, sorry.
Okay, when you convert your Korean money into dollars, you get less of them because the dollar is so strong.
Oh, yeah.
So if the Koreans are buying their Pepsi with a yuan, and then you gain up a pile of yuan and you have to convert them into dollars, you're going to get less in the way of dollars.
Pepsi priests, right? The S&P, they live on international earnings. That's going to hurt. There's going to be a day of reckoning here.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it many times in my life. When things look good, they look great. You go into the sky. But that's when you have to really pull down and stop buying.
He'd be a good central banker, that
man,
Carl.
Old Carl. Yeah.
Lean against the wind, yeah.
I guess that's how he's got so rich.
Yeah, exactly. Lean against the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two, and this is something Scott the Trader talks about all the time as well. You know, not buying at the peak. Decide that you want something or you don't want something, and then act when the market is at its high or at its low, in opposite of what you would think. So when the market is very high, you should be a seller, and when it's very low, you should be a buyer. As long as that's coupled with research, which Carl Icahn specializes in, then you'll be successful. You can't help it.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email. Let's see.
While you're looking,
yeah.
It's important to understand the two forces that are really on the horizon, fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, and understanding the two, the difference between the two. So the sense that fiscal stimulus is through government spending policies, you either stimulate or destimulate the economy. So the thought is that if Donald Trump is elected, even though his pledge to rebuild the military and to have a massive highway road program, my general belief is that he would cut government spending, which would not provide any fiscal stimulus. Whereas Hillary Clinton will do the opposite, which will provide great fiscal stimulus. And then the other side is the monetary stimulus, where the Federal Reserve steps into the marketplace and exchanges assets. So they create new dollars and exchange them for debt instruments of various sorts. And in the case of Japan, they actually buy stocks and real estate.
Mm-hmm.
So this sort of monetary stimulus has been largely absent from the U.S. market, which has kept the dollar in a stronger position.
I saw an article here that the Fed thinks that it's going to take, where is this? Where's the headline? It's going to take six more trillion to keep things going.
Right.
What? Huh. Really?
Yes. And it's important to understand this, that
Fed admits another $4 trillion in QE right. will be needed to offset an economic shock.
That's right.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes.
In what period of time? Like,
well, over the same period of time, I think that the more of the same is what the Fed is promising us. So if you look at what they've done over the last 8 years, call it roughly $500 billion per year,
mm-hmm.
which is close to the federal budget deficit. So if you can't...
$4 trillion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I read an economist. Somebody sent me a guy, his work, where he was actually quoting that whole crowding out effect, you know, the guns versus the butter thing. Like, so because the federal government is running a $500 billion deficit, if they dip into the existing supply of money, then they will crowd out all of the private borrowers and drive interest rates up. So nobody's going to loan money to Joe's shoe shop when they can loan it to the federal government instead. And so he made the case in that rather vacuous environment that this is exactly what would happen if the Fed didn't do its stimulus, didn't put in its $500 billion a year, that the federal government would actually crowd out and cause interest rates to rise.
Somebody sent us a little email here about the how donations to political campaigns are now tax deductible
right.
and limited in their amount, and yet if one donates to the Clinton Foundation, they are both tax deductible and not limited.
That's right.
In the process of checking this out, a friend of mine from Europe sent me this from a German friend of YouTube. This was pulled from a speech in the Bilderberg Group, old President Obama. She said it's only 19 seconds. I haven't listened to it, but let's click on it and see what it says, okay? Okay, let's see.
And for the international order that we have worked for generations to build. Ordinary
yeah.
men and women
mm-hmm.
are too small-minded to govern their own affairs.
Ooh.
Nice.
Jeez.
That order
nice.
And progress can only come when individuals surrender their rights to an all-powerful sovereign.
What? No, he was being...
I hope that was cut. I hope that was all cut.
Yeah, that he wouldn't say that.
Or he wouldn't mean it.
No, I think this
and
is...
And for the international order that we have worked for generations to build.
Yeah, that...
Ordinary men and women are too small-minded to...
Okay, so this is not fair.
No.
He didn't say... He was saying
say
that
like
some
that.
People say yeah, that say ordinary that. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, come
yeah.
on. Boy, you got to be careful.
Yeah, you do.
Got to be careful with
yeah,
you.
It's cut.
Cut. Yeah.
Cut. Thin cut.
Photoshop.
It's been Photoshop.
I mean, I'm not to... Not, you
not
know,
that he doesn't believe
not
that.
Not that he doesn't believe that, but he's not going to say that.
No, probably. They have spent generations building this world order. This is something, you know, from
sure.
the founding of the Federal Reserve. Actually, if you go back to the assassination of Lincoln and the National Banking Act, that would probably be the genesis of the current crowd.
Ooh, okay, that sounds gooey. Okay, so President Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater.
Yeah.
And the conjecture is that he was shot because he started screwing with the money.
He did.
He
was finishing.
He was in it. So then yeah. with the National Banking Act, what was that?
Well, that essentially was the forerunner of the Federal Reserve. It created this National Banking Association that allowed for, it was, I guess, the Glass-Steagall of its time. It allowed banks to move cross-border and to be national banks, not just the Bank of Dripping Springs. It's the National Bank of Dripping Springs. So it therefore participates with other national banks in a cartel or consortium. And issues greenbacks, issues a uniform currency that's created by the comptroller of the currency. So the way the national banks would work is you want to start a bank? Great. You buy $3 million worth of government bonds. You give them to the comptroller of the currency. He prints up $3 million worth of national bank notes and sends them to you. So now you have both the bond, which is on deposit with him, and the notes, which you can then loan into circulation. And that's how the National Banking Act was born.
Kind of cool.
It is kind of cool for the banks. Double your money, right?
Double your money right away. So, but you have to originally have the $3 million.
Well, yes, yeah, and that wasn't a problem for the moneyed men of the
sure,
day. That was not a problem.
So they
pooled their money together, and the Chases and the Rockefellers and the so-ons started the Crockers in California and others. So they each started
a bank.
A national bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then the national banks conspired or worked together, mm-hmm. however you want to call that, mm-hmm. To crowd out and disenfranchise the state banks. So because they were obviously more powerful, they could move across borders, and they prompted regulations that made it more difficult to be a state bank.
Mm-hmm.
And by the turn of early 1900, many of the state banks had been run out of business, and all that remained were these powerful national banks and this national banking cartel, which eventually morphed into the Federal Reserve and the first Federal Reserve Act.
Mm-hmm.
1913.
Now, Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss. We had a fellow on this show Monday, Francis Richard Connolly, who did this 3.5-hour video called JFK to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a rich man's trick, and he taught us a lot about the Bushes and the Nazis and financing the war,
sure,
and that whole thing. And that's all kind of true, isn't it?
It is entirely true.
He just wasn't making this up.
No. The participation of Prescott Bush and Brown Brothers Harriman and the other Anglophiles that essentially betrayed the United States at the expense of the working class for the benefit of the British.
Ooh, that's ugly.
Yeah. Carol Quigley wrote a great book, The Anglo-American Establishment.
Uh-huh.
And there are things like the Pilgrim Society and the Trilateral Commission, right, which grows out of the work of the Fabian Socialists with Cecil Rhodes and the Webb House and that whole mm-hmm. circle of socialists that it essentially infiltrated the organizations that make up the world body. And you move into World War II and you find Harry Dexter White working behind the scenes for the banks.
Mm. It gets ugly.
Yeah, it does.
I don't know what year this was, but we got a little tape here of George H. is at 41,
right,
talking to similar. Let's see what he's got to say here.
Sounds like Bohemian Grove.
Yeah. I don't know why.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
Oh, I feel better already. The scariest part of the speech. Oh,
when we are successful, and we will be.
Oh, the UN.
We have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
Don't you love the music?
Yeah, they cut that spooky music in behind it.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good. So George said it. So, you know, I've heard over the years that people are really, the whole UN thing is just really like, they just turn blue when you start talking about the UN.
Well, of course.
Is it a spooky organization?
Those of us who have studied and understand exactly what the UN is all about.
It's always something with you, Andrew.
Well, no, the UN, no question, is what its intent was.
Yeah.
Is to steal the sovereignty of every nation on Earth and rest it in that monolith of a building.
Really?
Yeah. Land was donated.
New York City, huh?
Yeah. Land was donated by the Rockefellers.
Oh, good.
And their organization was blessed by the leadership of every nation. And the idea being, well, we surrender our sovereignty to you, And then you now become the super state, you know, the massive government that tells us what to do.
Really? So, and where did they get their power from? A bunch of rich people gave them a bunch of money and they said you're powerful? I mean, pretty much. I mean, they just kind of
corrupted, corrupted our leaders to betray the United States and to sign over the sovereignty of the nation to this super nation. That's what the UN is. You know, here's money, you get a police force, you get to have your own army. And
that's all it is, right?
Yeah, it's just...
Just by some decree.
Correct. Correct.
So a bunch of countries didn't all get together and say, let's do this.
No. A bunch of countries with a gun to their head and a Marshall Plan bribe, you know. You sign on to this and we'll take care of everything. You won't have to worry. We'll rebuild your nation. I mean, you just came out of a major war, World War II.
Sure, yeah, let's fix it.
Well, when Woodrow Wilson first proposed this, and of course the link between Woodrow and the Bushes is unmistakable, the intent was the same. It was the League of Nations, and we were all supposed to surrender our national sovereignty to this League of Nations, and they would solve the world's problems. And to a man, the United States just booed that idea down. Just the thought of it was insane. So
weird.
It took a couple more wars before we became pliable enough to recognize the need for such an international organization. And now we have it. And it each year exerts more jurisdictional authority over different areas that we're surprised that they have jurisdiction over. You know, they've commented on everything from the environment to gun control to rights to the, you know, whether
And also, excuse me, I think the whole nutritional thing,
that's
too.
Right.
They're
that's
in
right.
on that, aren't they?
And whether
that's
or not you can spank your children and so on. All
really?
This is, these are all UN mandates.
Good for them. Mm-hmm. Man. And this has been a long time in the making. This is nothing recent.
No, it's nothing recent.
Okay.
No, the idea of a global government of one single authority that would protect the rich and oppress the poor, that's been the dream of those. I mean, it surprises me that folks understand, you know, a bunch of evil people will get together and decide how to take over a company or how to take over a town or how to take over a state or maybe even a country. But the idea that they would think about taking over the world, no. They'd stop there. They'd draw the line. They wouldn't do that. I'm here to tell you that from the days of the Banana Republics, once the rich American and English businessmen found out that they could literally take over a country, as in the case of United Fruit Company and the incursions of the Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, you know, they saw they could influence things in a country and effectively own it. There's the corporate state that we spoke about, you know, the fascism. So, yeah, back home we have our constitution and all those freedoms, but here in the Middle East, we're going to install a dictator and run the place like a prison camp.
Yeah. I pulled Richard Mayberry's book off the shelf this morning. Interesting that you bring it up, called A Thousand-Year War in the Mideast.
Yeah.
And I recommend it for all the moms and grandmas and aunts and uncles out there. It's written in the Uncle Eric series, where it's very easy to read. It's for teenagers, and it's very easy for then Patrick to understand it if it's written for teenagers. And it's really amazing, some of the history about the boys and getting into the Mideast and what this whole place is about and how, wow, it's just fascinating. Man, they've been in there a long time.
Yeah, they have.
They've been in there a long time. England, UK.
Yeah.
The oil companies.
Oh, sure.
Long time.
From the beginning.
So they were in on, I think, weren't they in on, if I remember the book, I'm going to reread it, they were in on the idea when they split up places like Iraq.
Easier to manage.
Yeah, easier to manage in Syria and all these different countries. They were in on putting the borders up and putting the people in. And
absolutely.
Getting it all started, man.
Fencing off their property.
Yeah, we got some things going on here. Man, just amazing.
Yeah.
There's some... new thing out is here, there's a new chapter in the IMF. The UK Telegraph headlines recently, the IMF admits disastrous love affair with the euro and apologizes for the downfall of Greece. The IMF's top misled their own board, made a series of misjudgments in Greece, became euphoric cheerleaders for the euro project, ignored warnings of impending crisis. This is all
yeah.
on record. They yeah. knew that the euro, the IMF knew that the euro had serious flaws.
Of course they
did.
They
know long ago.
But they wanted the dream so badly that they turned the other cheek, as it were. And probably somebody even said to Goldman Sachs, hey, go in there and show Italy how to cook their books so they can get in.
Yeah. Man, it's just... So do you think this thing is going to hold together, and does it matter to the United States or the dollar? The, you know, there's people saying this thing's going to fall apart. Maybe France is next. Maybe Italy's next.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's like that Bronx Tale thing, right? The Bronx Tale.
The Bronx Tale?
Where they locked them in the room. Now yous can't leave. You know,
now yous, can't yous guys leave. Can't go.
You're in. You can't. Yous can't leave. Look at, even though Britain, British people voted to do this, they haven't. They still haven't triggered it. We still...
Oh, the Brexit thing.
Yeah, we still haven't seen the British exit. So any other country will have a tough row to follow, that's for sure. But I've heard the rumors, you know, obviously Le Pen in France, and we were on Grillo Beppo, was he our Italian guy?
My Italian guy.
So, but the rise of nationalism, and I, you know, I heard somebody yesterday on one of the Bloomberg networks talking about this very thing, this bad thing, that Donald Trump represents, and that's the nationalist, the nativist idea that this is America for Americans and, you know, the heck with everybody else. They even use that X word again, xenophobe.
Xenophobe. Are you a xenophobe?
Xenophobic. I'm a xenophobic nationalist. I believe in America first, the American people first, and I fear and distrust foreigners. That's what the xenophobe label is all about. So anyway, this is put forward as a bad thing, and I don't view it as that. I'm proud of this nation. I know that in New York City they're moving to take the flags off of the American fire truck because it's too sectional. You know, it creates divisiveness within foreign communities. So in New York City we have Little Colombia, Little Russia, you know, people kind of move in groups and they fly the flag of their country here on our soil. And so we don't want to offend them by bringing in a fire truck with an American flag. Really? I don't think the Mexican flag should be flown in the United States myself, other than on someone's house, you know. So I'm divided on this whole issue, but the idea, this is what I think this election comes down to. You're either a globalist and you believe that we're one citizen in the whole world and we have no more rights than somebody in some other part of the world. Or you're a nationalist, which believes that America is the greatest nation and the American people are the greatest nation. Our form of law and our constitution is the greatest formation document on the planet. You know, we're the best of the best of the best. So that's the decision in this election. You know, which side do you want to sit on?
Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, and we're gonna talk about birds and the bees here in the trees. That's it for now.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network. It's the Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. Once again, here's Patrick.
And let's grab a telephone call here. Good morning on the telephone. Who's this? Hello.
This is Denise from Dallas.
Hi, Denise. Good morning.
I just wanted to expand on what Mr. Goss was talking about as far as the nationalism. I think on a spiritual level, it's really about people, immigrants, if they have become Americans or not. Because back in the day, when we had people coming from Italy, from this country, from that country, and they spoke their language, but their parents insisted that they learn English, and it was a shameful thing not to know English. And we need to get back, you know, it's about people becoming Americans. And then, you know, then everything will work.
Oh, wait a minute. Andrew, sorry, yeah, your microphone was off. Yeah.
No, as I've said many times on the show, while I support a building of the wall on the southern border, I want it to have a gate. And if someone wants to knock on the door and say, I want to be an American, I want to swear to uphold and defend the Constitution. I want to come in and work and pitch in and be American. Of course, I want them in this country. I want there to be a gate. Anyone who wants to be American. But if you want to sneak into this country and continue to be whatever you are, with no allegiance or support for the United States or your fellow Americans, I don't want you here. Go back where you came from.
Exactly.
Okay, Denise, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Let's see. Lucretia writes in, is Andy aware of this story? Is it true that the U.S. Mint halts Silver Eagle coin production due to lack of demand?
No.
That's probably not true.
No, maybe due to lack of supply. I'll believe that. They are having trouble getting the blanks that these things are made on, but not through lack of demand. Goodness, that's been the it's been the opposite story for years.
Let's do another piece of tape here. This will be fun. This is Mr. Icon again on on business. What Andrew was talking about and what he thinks Trump can do if he's working with regulations.
Well, I think I made it pretty clear all through the campaign, right at the beginning, that I think Trump's policies are possibly the only thing that's going to save us from going down this decline that we're in on productivity, which is very important in this country. I really think that we've had a tremendous decline in capital spending, which everybody knows. I'm not making that up, and a major decline in productivity growth. Now, if you think about that, I think one of the major reasons for it, and I'm a little microcosm of it, is that some of these regulatory agencies, the EPA in particular, and certain things, I'm not against regulation. I think certain regulation is very important. I'm not even against some of the financial regulation that you have. I think that that some of the investment banks really cause a lot of problems in 08. But I am against what I consider to be just arbitrary and capricious regulation, such as what the EPA is now doing concerning a refinery. So that's a microcosm of what I'm talking about, which absolutely scares business. Business looks at this as a war between business and government. A CEO and even a mediocre CEO, and I'm certainly no fan of mediocre CEOs. There are very good ones, but many mediocre ones that go in and say, okay, we got the great advantage of zero interest rates, and what we're going to do is borrow money, buy back stock instead of investing in capital, which gets their stock up. They're vested. They make 50, 100 million bucks or whatever they make, and they go play golf the rest of their lives. And the worker, the middle-class worker, suffers greatly from it, which they are today. You need someone to come in with a fresh broom and, in certain cases, with these regulatory agencies, take hold of what they're doing and showing business that we're not against them.
Okay.
And that's why I'm for Trump, and that's the whole story in a nutshell.
Okay, Carl. That's Carl Icahn. Guess he's for Trump.
Sounds that way.
Yes, I guess he is. Did you see the list of the hedge funds of how much they've given compared to what they've given to Donald Trump?
And yeah.
Would you see? Isn't it amazing? What's it 50? I mean, it's like 50-1 or something.
They don't want him. That's
Man,
for sure.
They don't want anything to do with him.
No, no.
And they're afraid of him. What are some of the other reasons you've talked about him on the show?
Carried interest. You know, their ability to have carried interest as a deduction on their tax return really.
What is carried interest?
Well, it's essentially the cost of capital. And, you know, the cost of making a bet for or against something involves borrowed money. And so the interest that you pay is untaxed.
The interest that you pay on the borrowed money is not taxed. Is that right?
Yes.
It's not a deduction.
No, it's a carry. It's the carry trade.
Okay, carry trade. Oh, that's
yeah,
carry trade.
Right.
So you borrow $1 million and then with Mr. Trump, that would change.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah. It's actually the portion of the interest that's paid to the guy that started the whole thing. or to the company that started the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
But it's deductible to the fund and not taxable to the receiver. Anyway, it's a share of the profits, essentially, that's paid out in interest.
Okay.
The cost, I
can go with that.
Yeah. It's the cost to keep, to have the thing. And the general partner or the of the limited partnership can charge a fee above and beyond what they put in. That's considered interest. So it's a contractual right.
Do you think there's going to be any kind of October, what do they call it, October surprise from the administration or the people they control to make things look better for the Democrats in November?
No.
Do they have any kind of bunnies to
pull? Well, I'm sure there are always those sorts of tricks, but I'm more worried about the regulatory reforms that start cutting in around the middle of October. That one about the money markets is particularly frightening because it divides the money market funds into two categories. Ones that can break the buck and ones that can't.
Really? Yeah. This is a new thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So folks in money markets are less going to be less safe in a month than they are today.
That's correct.
Because they can do what now?
Well, they can break the buck.
Which they did, what was it,
well, 80, yeah, 89, but it was unusual and it's not supposed to happen. Now they're going to have a whole category of money market funds that I'm sure will give a greater return, but will have the...
Put it over here. It's more interest.
Yeah, you get more interest, but at the same time, they're allowed to break the buck.
Which means, tell folks what that means.
Well, they're allowed to, let's say you buy in and the shares of the thing are a dollar, and breaking the buck means that suddenly the shares are 50 cents. So that there essentially be two categories of money market fund, one that can pay you less than face value at any time, and one that would have to pay at least face value, so the kind that can't break the buck. And that's that's going into effect by the second week of October, and that could cause a lot of people to sell a lot of funds and create a cash crunch or a liquidity crunch.
So, folks in money markets now they're going to need to be alert.
Right.
Of if somebody says you want to do this, you want to do this, there'll be more interest. Be careful if you're going to be start moving stuff around.
Right.
In your money market.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to stay station break.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, hour two of the Real World of Money. Join us, 888-663-6386. Email is a fair, right? Computer in front of me. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Philadelphia Fed. New orders plunge. Employment crashes to 7-year lows. There seem to be a lot of chum in the water for a fellow like Mr. Trump to be talking about with the Democratic financial thing that they've got going on, doesn't it? Seems like a lot of stuff.
Man. Yeah, I definitely do.
Just keep on piling it on. These unemployment numbers are pretty interesting. I mean, it's nowhere close, is it? What they tell us.
No. Because of that workforce participation rate, that's the one right there. If you Google that, workforce participation rate, you'll find that it's in the low 60 percentile. So what it means is that of the people that are able to work in this country, only 62% are participating in the workforce. Now, how are they participating in the workforce? Well, they either have a job or they're looking for a job. Okay, so then what percentage of that 62% are looking for a job? Well, it's only 5%. And that's how you get the report of 5% unemployment. It's 5% of 62%.
5% of 60, yeah. That's clever how they do it.
Yeah, it's clever, but it's misleading, and that's why Uncle Sam cooks the books.
Is this anything to an aha moment? Or there's been a whole bunch of net dollars leaving the foreign holders of U.S. treasuries. There's been $335 billion, wow, quarter of a trillion, from June 15 to June 16.
Yeah.
This article says this was kind of unprecedented. Is there anything up that means anything?
Well, other than...
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, positioning yourselves in advance. And this is one of the things that... the collapsitarians and crashaholics worry about and talk about all the time.
When they're having a beer and...
Whenever.
Whenever.
Is the idea that the rest of the world will stop storing dollars.
They're just not going to want our dollars anymore.
They don't want our dollars anymore. Right. So they have to go someplace.
Right.
And where is it that they're going to go? Well, back to the only place where they're good, here in the United States. And they're going to buy things. And boy, things are sure being bought. That's for sure. So the idea that foreign holders of United States debt will start cashing in their bonds and buying tangible assets are one of the inflation fuels that lead me to that convergence picture, the picture of convergence where inflation is run amok as folks sell their treasury-denominated debt, their corporate debt. Corporate default rate in the U.S. is expected to jump by 30%. By the middle of next year.
Wow,
so,
30%.
It's going to jump. It's expected to jump 30%, according to a story in USA Today a couple days ago. So the idea that we're getting ready for the defaults and the risk of those defaults just keeps getting bigger and bigger. We've already talked about the municipal bond market and its propensity to ignore risk. Certainly there's a danger there, and several others. The risk, default risk, just keeps rising every month.
There's an interesting little article about from Dr. Judy Shelton. She's an economist, and she's on the Trump economic team. And here's what she says. She says, what concerns me is that central banks around the world, ECB, the Bank of Japan, are now buying corporate assets. I'm wondering how far away we are from the Fed thinking it needs to branch out and buy corporate assets. Has she been listening to this show?
May have.
These corporate assets be those from firms that are politically connected?
There's your fascism.
Yeah. Pretty interesting lady talking about this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She said, don't attribute this idea, says this doctor on his team, to the Trump campaign. But it has been something that I've been proposing for years now. A gold-backed bond was first promoted in 1981 by Alan Greenspan.
Yeah.
I think the U.S. should issue them as an experimental pilot program similar to the TIPS bond. The compensation people who are concerned about the future value of the dollar, for those who are concerned about the big financial meltdown, these bonds would give them some insurance as gold tends to rise in price during periods of financial stress.
Uh-huh.
Wow, good for her.
Yes.
Man.
Exactly. So if you couple a bond, or if you make a treasury bond gold-backed, so if, for example, you take
could
the spot...
Could you do that?
Well, sure you could, yeah.
Okay.
You take the spot price of gold today when the bond is purchased, say, $13.25,
okay.
And you divide that by 10,000, say it's a $10,000 bond.
Yeah.
Whatever that formula is for the instant value of the bond, whether at discount or at face value, you put that much gold behind it, and you sell the bond, yielding a very low rate of return.
Like 0.25 or 1 or 0.5 or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the holder of the bond knows that the bond is backed by 70 ounces of gold. So regardless of whether interest rates rise or fall, the compensation for inflation would be paid in the form of a higher gold price, so a gold-backed bond. I have so many of them. They were deemed irrelevant by the Confiscation Act of both 34, excuse me. And,
you mean there were gold-backed bonds
absolutely.
Pre-33?
Oh, sure.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of the railroad bonds, a lot of the building bonds. In fact, one particular bond wasn't a bond, really. It was a note. It was a building lease. I believe it was in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And it it called for the payment of X amount of dollars in gold.
Yeah.
And on the renewal, the guy wanted to just pay the gold and was not allowed to do so. So court struck down the gold portion of the contract.
So let me get this straight, though. Say I buy a $10,000 gold-backed bond, and the interest rates go cattywampus on me. I'm protected because I've got
70 ounces of gold.
70 ounces of gold because at 13.2. So, wow.
Yeah.
And why would you do that if you don't have to do it now?
Who, the issuing authority?
Yeah, the issuing authority. Yeah, yeah. Why would Dr. Judy Shelton's idea get to Trump's desk and say, let's do this? Why would you do it?
No good reason.
There's no really good.
Other than looking out for the person that's actually buying the bond.
Right.
See,
so it'd be a good reason, but not a reason government generally does.
Exactly. Right. It would actually be good for the people that were buying the bond, so no chance that they're going to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So if you were a billionaire and you were wanted to invest in other countries, Andrew Goss, would you be going somewhere else other than in the United States? Or?
Oh, I wouldn't be Andrew
Goss. Would you be buying the Chinese yuan like that?
No, I would not.
Mm-hmm.
No, uh-uh.
The Iranian rial.
No,
rial.
No, none of them.
No,
the Australian dollar. I noticed some of the miners in Australia, I think Glencore, yesterday sold its gold output for the foreseeable future for a fixed lump sum today.
What do you mean?
Well, I think
this huge mine in Australia. Huh?
Yeah, sold its future production, 100% of its gold production, for I think it was $567 million.
Why would they do that?
Because they need the money. Glencore, we talked about the struggles that they've been enduring with gold prices at their low, and it's really affected the company's balance sheet. So in this way, they pre-sell their gold production and get a lump sum of cash to help healthy up the balance sheet.
Well, gold prices really aren't low. I mean, they're all-time highs, right?
No,
of course. Yeah, we had 1,900. But that was just
it was 2,000.
That was just a persnickety
17
thing.
And 18 were certainly there. So at 13.
Was it up there for a long time? I don't even recall.
It was a
1,700,
1,800. For a season, put it that
was
way.
It?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Huh. Yeah. So for those of you who think that the Iranian hostage deal, I mean the Iranian, whatever, the nuke deal.
Ransom.
You know, and the hostage thing was you know, according to this article, this was really, as Andrew Goss predicted, this was about the dollar.
Yeah.
This is about the dollar and the real, and they're doing away with some two-tier exchange rate so they can be cozy up more with the dollar. Oh,
yes.
I'm surprised that these revolutionary Muslim kind of dudes are all bankers, too.
Right, that's it.
They're bankers,
yes,
too.
Yes, they're all Swiss.
They're
yes,
all Swiss, man.
All
Isn't
Swiss.
That amazing?
Yeah, yeah.
What this thing was about? I mean,
right.
More and more.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the bankers got in there and...
Yeah, and the additional argument, well, we owed them 1.7, but
right.
The other 1.3 we just paid through normal central bank activity.
That's right, we just paid them.
Wait a minute, why didn't you pay the 400 that way? Well, because that had to get passed out to the guys that were actually running the show over there.
And that's why I had to put it on a pallet of $100 bills and fly it in on the tarmac so they'd release these guys.
Yeah.
Boy, they got caught with that one. But,
man,
the media forgot about that real quick.
Well, no, yesterday they were jumping on it yesterday because
really?
The State Department characterized it. It wasn't ransom.
Hmm.
It was leverage.
Leverage. I like it. Okay.
And so then the press secretary of the White House spent the day trying to explain the difference between leverage and ransom and got, you know, rather persnickety in several exchanges about the characterization. So, I remember something Dan Rather said, if it walks like a duck.
Talks like a duck, it's a duck.
Quacks like a duck.
It's a duck.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Check this out. Top 25 corporate pension plans.
Mm-hmm.
They're shy about $250 billion, $225 billion. That's a B. Oh, man, corporate pension plan. So that would be, I don't know, I work for whatever, Shell Oil or something, or maybe not the oil company.
Well, you have to actually pick an American company.
Yeah, that's true. That's not, are there any American
Are there any left?
Okay,
yes.
Wait a minute. Walmart?
No, no. Well, maybe. Okay, you work for Walmart.
I work for Walmart, and I got a pension thing.
You're not getting a pension. Yeah.
Can they just cut those like that? I mean, is it fair? Can you do that? Can you just say, okay, well, we're short?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's ugly.
Yeah. It is ugly. Yeah.
Hmm. Another email here. Sorry. My little mouse is not working. I've lost enough. Steve writes, I have lost enough on my precious metals IRA due to the games the boys play. Hmm. That the 59.5, I took it out, but cannot afford to take a further loss and ship it, say, to your office to get a collectible that I can use for hedging as well as supplementing my retirement. So other than the waiting game on the bullion to make advances before possible conversion, I can keep my junk silver. But what is your opinion on the mint issues of the Silver Proof American, the beautiful quarters and the like? If a good find, what's a good price from Portsmouth, Virginia?
Yeah, I think anything.
So what's he talking about first off with his precious metals IRA?
Yeah,
so what did he do?
So he's watched, he probably, forgive me, bought in at a high point and has watched the precious metals. You know, I feel so bad about this, but you know when gold was 18 and 1900, you remember? Mm-hmm. People were calling into the show telling us it was going to 2500.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had been telling them for months, if not years, you know, all the way back to when gold was 288, that they should be adding gold coins to their portfolio, but a great many waited until it was 16, 17, 1800, and then they decided to plunk all their money in at the same time. So maybe that was one of these, but now precious metals have been falling, and the value of his IRA has been falling. And he can't wait, I think was the point. He can't take any more out.
Let's see what he says, but I cannot afford to take a further loss and ship it to, say, your office to get a collectible that I can use for hedging.
Correct. So that's, for him, not an option, he views. Now, my sense is that, A, your first loss is your best loss. You know, just go ahead and write it off and
go for it.
Yeah, switch it into something that has a potential to rise, whether or not gold and silver is rising.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly is United States rare, very rare coins. So most certainly that would make sense. However, he says it doesn't make sense for him. And should he buy any of the modern issues of the Mint, and thinking again to make a quick score? And I would say no again. In fact, I can
but
sell.
But at 18, isn't silver a buy? No matter
yeah, it
what
is
you,
a buy.
No what form you get
but
it
But when you're
in?
Paying 38 or 40 for a coin that might become collectible.
Oh, okay.
Right? That's the proof silver issues from the Mint or the silver quarters that are being issued or any of the ceremonial strikings that are being made by the U.S. Mint. They have a high retail cost when they're put to the consumer. It's already at a significant premium over its metal content.
Gotcha.
And then it historically tends to drift lower as the secondary market absorbs these enormous supplies. So I don't like speculating on whether or not something will become rare. I prefer to buy something that's already rare, already recognized as a rarity, and will only continue to become more rare as attrition and demand push its price up. So you can't get that with a mint-issued product where they're making 200 million of something and every one of them is in pristine condition. You're just not going to find it. And if you're looking for that hit where, you know, you buy something for a dollar and it suddenly shoots up to $3 or $4.
We like that.
That's happened a few times in the U.S. Mint's offerings. But generally, if you bought everything that the Mint had to offer, even the winners wouldn't make up for all the losers that the Mint cranks out. So it takes many decades and lots of silver price and gold price increases to finally recoup the premiums that are paid to the U.S. Mint.
Andrew Goss and Patrick Timpone, and it is the real world of money.
Broadcasting live, weekday morning, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
I knew that. 888-663-6386 email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Okay, let's see here. email. Has Andy studied raw materials economics found explained on the web at normeconomics.org? It appears that raw material economics has vaporized from our schools and social discourse after World War II, when free trade took over the discourse in economics. I just discovered this body of knowledge, and it's still the first time I understand how an economy works. The basic premise is all wealth comes from the earth. By undercutting the price of commodities through free trade after 1953, the small and medium-sized farmer was driven out, leaving corporate farming destroyed, destroying the humus of our soils and contributing to climate change issues, since the humus-fed soil is the major sink for carbon from the air. Why do this? For profit? Hell no. If you break the farmer, then the rest of the economy is driven down in income and wages, and here comes the debt money banking system. Create money out of thin air to help us all out. Wow.
Raw material economics, that's like, you know, Ben Franklin in the United States.
Yeah, it's normeconomics.org.
Remember when I've said there are only four ways to actually create wealth, right?
No, what are
mining, fishing, mining, farming, manufacturing.
Is that right?
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah, raw material.
No, wait a minute. No, I was going to do an app for, you know, Kim Kardashian.
I guess that's manufacturing.
That's manufacturing. Yeah. All right.
So, but the raw material supply is what affects how many jobs there are in the processing of this raw material.
Material supply affects process. Okay.
Yeah, if you have, you know, lots of wheat to make into bread, you need a lot of people to make the bread. Ship the wheat and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are a lot of raw materials being produced, then there are a lot of jobs in the conversion, processing, fabrication, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
of this raw material.
Right.
And naturally, if you cut it, if you cut the production of raw material, what else are you cutting? Jobs, right? There are none after that.
That's it. They're just not there. Yeah. And don't you find it interesting karmically that I do, that these rare earth minerals, the ones that this whole technological thing is based on, right? iPhones, Priuses, or Teslas, all these rare earth minerals, most of them are over there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, not here.
Most of them are over there in the Mideast mm-hmm. and China, I guess, do they? Australia. Australia,
right.
Canada. But mostly in the Mideast.
Yep.
Not
here.
Not here. Not in Kansas.
No,
we got corn in Kansas.
Yeah, no, and you know, our uranium production now belongs to the Russians, thanks to Hillary Clinton and Frank Joustra.
What? So
the production of uranium in the United States was consolidated by a Canadian company headed by a man named Frank Joustra.
Joustra.
And sold to the Russians with the blessing of the Clinton Foundation, with the blessing of the Clinton State Department.
Really?
So,
was that a Freudian slip there?
It was, yes. Forgive me.
Well, I think it's hilarious that Ms. Clinton is accusing Mr. Trump of being friends with...
that's right.
Mr. Putin.
Yeah, she's the one who's actually taking the money from him. So back to raw materials.
Yeah, raw materials.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
There is no question that everything in this country is based on the production of raw materials. And, you know, mining, farming, fishing, manufacturing. And notice how each of those industries is being assailed because, again, there are the only true means of producing wealth. Everything else is just moving it around.
So if you just fast forward, and I'm not saying this so, you know, to be a Trump supporter, but just in logic, if more manufacturing does not somehow find its way back into this country, people are still making babies. Now, they're not making a lot, they're still making babies. And there are some kids that can't afford, don't want, don't have the intellectual capacity. It's not what they want to do to be computer geeks. They've got, and if they do not, They have the wherewithal to start their own little creative business, as you often, you know, recommend. They still need jobs. I mean, people still make babies in Michigan.
So go plant
in Ohio.
Tree.
I mean, they still. So where are these kids going to work?
Yeah, where are they?
Where are they going to work?
Well, they could produce some raw materials. So get out there and make something. Production is the key. We need to produce. So the heck with all this trickle down. Keynesian supply side economics.
You got to make something.
That's right.
That you could sell at a profit.
Yeah.
If you don't do that, you know, nothing's going on.
Man. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I also muse sometimes of how far you can carry this technological stuff. I mean, do you think they'll run out of stuff to do?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Like,
no,
give me some ideas.
You'll simply increase our ability to produce. You increase productivity.
Oh, you mean with robots?
With robots or other automated functions. And our ability to have a robot is, you know, not going to be stopped. And our ability
self-driving cars and
mechanized
stuff.
Farming and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is, in fact, the idea that we must produce. And so the raw material of this nation, if you recall, when President Obama suggested a $10 tax on every barrel of oil, I countered with a $20 tariff on imported barrels of oil. Now, what does that do? Well, it encourages the production of domestic oil, more jobs drilling oil domestically and putting it into the marketplace free of that tariff while protecting that industry with a $20 tariff on anything imported. So if it's imported oil, you add a $20 tax on it. If it's domestically produced oil, you don't tax it. That increases, that gives you that cycle of production and processing and consumption and distribution, right? All the everything that goes along with drilling an oil barrel out of the ground and turning it into a gallon of gasoline. So I guess I am a fan of, what was it, natural economic law? Is that what we're talking about?
That was a very good, Professor. You should have your own course.
Tanks. Jeeps and army men.
Jeeps and tanks. Do you think we'll ever, as a culture, as a nation, be able to figure out how to survive without war? I mean, it's embedded in our everything, isn't it, Andrew? I mean, you're talking, $1 trillion at least. Well, on the back of an envelope.
Stop wanting other people's stuff.
Yeah, but...
You know, this is what it's all about, isn't it, right? We want other people's stuff.
Yeah.
And we try to talk them into giving it to us. And then when they don't, we beat them up. I mean, that's the bully way. So I would avoid economic entanglements altogether. I'm too much of a protectionist to ask that question to. The answer is you want to stop war, stop dealing with these people. That's all. Just stop taking what they have and stop giving them what you have. That's essentially it. Be ready to defend yourself. What did that Indonesian prime minister say? If you guys don't sign this TPP, it could lead to World War III. You either let us sell our goods in your country... We produce them, and then we sell them to you. And so then our country does great. Your country does very poorly. Because while you're consuming all this stuff, no one is producing it. And if no one is producing it, there's no raw materials to start with. There's no jobs to go with it.
I am concerned about this country.
You should be.
You know, just looking at it from the broad, you know, perspective of what could possibly happen in the next 5, 10, 20 years.
Well, simple. Whew. Are what's left of the nation's business corporations gets up and leaves. And, you know, Pfizer, isn't that it's an Irish company now, I think, Pfizer, is buying up another giant drug company, $15 billion. So that's going to take all of the profits of that drug company and now tax it in Pfizer's home country, not in the United States. So as our corporations get up and leave, to escape oppressive taxation, they take with them jobs. And as those jobs leave, our cost or standard of living will fall.
Mm-hmm.
And as taxes on individuals start to increase, especially the rich, who have the greatest mobility of all, So, you know, you tell a rich person we're going to suddenly tax you excessively, then the rich person has the wherewithal to pack up their goods and leave and go to
which is what they do.
That's what they
do. I think they have, what is it, Andrew, Apple has a couple hundred billion in an Irish bank.
Yeah, almost 250 in an Irish bank.
$250 billion.
Uh-huh,
wow.
250, yeah.
I think they got a pretty good margins on those iPhones.
And that was the other portion of Mr. Trump's plan, to say to Apple, all right, look, we're only going to tax you 10% on that 250. Bring it back to the United States.
Bring it back and do something with
it. Yeah, do something with it. Yeah.
Just build factories or something.
Exactly. Hmm.
This is a pretty cool story. Rothschilds are buying gold on the greatest experiment with money in the history of the world. You see the picture of this dude, man. He is like old. The Lord Jacob Rothschild. He's warning about the results of the greatest experiment in monetary policy in the history of the world. Well, he's running it. What is he concerned about here?
Yeah, right.
I mean, like it's a surprise to him.
Yeah, surprise. Your whole thing is coming apart at the seams.
So they're
protect yourself.
So the Lord Jacob Rothschild says that they're going to start investing about up 8%. We're going to do 8% more in gold and sterling and all of this to navigate choppy, uncharted waters.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you like to know how much gold and silver this guy's got in the basement?
Yeah. Well, I know the amount of gold and that's piling up in Hong Kong is up. Some really? 90%. I mean, it's
they're really poning it in, huh?
They really are.
Who's selling it to, man?
Everybody and anybody, you know.
Man, if you got a buyer, people.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're out there in the open marketplace, surely making offers.
But anybody that can see what's going on in the world, why would you be selling your gold now? I mean, you need
money.
Venezuela.
Money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you can hold on to your gold if you can't eat.
So. You know, it's really kind of sorry when you think about it. Here's Venezuela down there, and they are actually trading gold for paper dollars. Think about that.
They need their paper dollars.
Yeah. Is that a cattywampus world or what?
Not really. I mean, anyone.
I mean, that's why it's set up. Sorry.
Perkins, yeah. The Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
It's crazy.
That's what they were set up to do. They were set up for that failure.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Let's see here.
But, you know, the Obama-Clinton plan of borrowing our way out of debt, well, that's certainly a wonderful concept.
Hmm. You know, it works so far. It's been working out. This is pretty cool. Let's see. Government reports find $6.5 trillion
missing.
Check this out. In taxpayer funds unaccounted for.
Right.
Have you seen this story?
Yeah, it's the Pentagon.
The Army made $2.8 trillion in wrongful adjustments to accomplish entries in one quarter alone in 2015 and $6.5 trillion for the year. You have no idea of where any of this money is going, and they're just cooking the books, man.
Correct.
Wow. Which resulted in the Pentagon being unable to account for up to $8 trillion in taxpayer funding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Wasn't that interesting that you go back to 9/11? What was it, the day before?
Yeah.
The day before, tell folks what happened.
Well, $2.3 trillion was missing.
And who announced it?
Well,
I think it was, the Secretary of Defense.
Understand that it's missing only in an accounting sense.
We don't know where it went.
Right. It just can't keep track of stuff, that's all.
And was it McNamara that said it? No. Was it McNamara?
No.
Who was the guy?
Yeah, what is his name?
What is his name? You know. What's his face? He was...
Rumsfeld.
Yeah. Rumsfeld. Oh, Rummy. He actually had a press conference, and he announced it. And then 9/11 happened the next day.
Yeah, well, yeah, but in that $2.3 trillion, just as in the $6.5 trillion, they just never recorded the transaction. And... you have to understand that the Pentagon uses antiquated, somehow, to think that the Pentagon took $8.5 trillion out of the Treasury last year and blew it without accounting for it.
That doesn't even seem right.
No, it's not. Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to, let's see, 96, it was a trillion. Because we know, how much do we spend annually on defense?
I think the budget is...
One.
What?
1 trillion.
Yeah, 1 trillion. Yeah, right, yeah, right at 1 trillion.
So you'd have to go back to what, 96, 97, 98, 99? You'd have to go back to 1996 and lose every dollar of the Pentagon's budget to the present day to make that, you know, $8.5 trillion or whatever the number is. They didn't lose it, they just spent it, and they didn't account for it with enough detail to supply to fund a full audit. So if they have that GAAP, if you were to use those accounting standards, they did not properly account for the money that they spent.
So they didn't really just blow $6 trillion.
No, they didn't. No. Well, six. I heard eight.
Yeah,
six
eight.
And a,
yeah.
6.5 or 8.5.
Eight. No, this article said for one. In one place it says six, and then they say eight.
Yeah.
You think you should proofread an article before you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Miss it by $2 trillion. Like, well, yeah. So $2 trillion.
So, but the GAO has done a great report, and so, I mean, you can find lots of waste and fraud inside.
And McDonald's,
the,
you know. I
mean, yeah, but inside the DOD, without an outlandish story like this. And, when, you know, when the numbers get big like that, everyone tends to just ignore the whole thing. The idea that the Pentagon could have lost 16 years of budget dollars in 1 year is absurd.
Mm-hmm. Is this a real story? Here's Bloomberg. Banks sprint to meet $493 trillion swaps market margin rules.
Right.
So let me just read the beginning of it.
Go ahead.
See if I understand. The world's largest banks are racing to meet a U.S. and Japanese deadline next month when billions of dollars in new collateral requirements will begin to hit the over-the-counter derivatives market even as new regulatory fault lines emerge. Firms are testing systems for exchanging collateral for the trades, signing new legal documents, and pursuing regulatory approval for models that could help blunt the cost of compliance, according to lawyers. So, what's going on here?
It's the margin rules.
What's going on here? Is this anything to talk about?
Yeah.
Is it meaningful?
It is meaningful. So
that's a lot of money. For what? What
400,
I said?
493 trillion dollars in derivatives,
yeah,
are at risk, shall we say. Okay, so the idea is simply this: under these new rules, you have to put up more in collateral to make one of these derivative transactions. So
okay.
If you want to option a certain number of bonds or a certain dollar amount of bonds, they require a premium payment up front. So let's say right now you want to borrow $1 million worth of bonds, it's going to cost you $10,000. Now you might have to pay $20,000 or $30,000, and your collateral has to be vetted and cleared before the transaction is allowed to occur.
Huh.
So they're just essentially cleaning up some of the sloppy margin rules that were in effect and allowed banks to borrow, you know, far more money than they attain leverage ratios of 40, 50 to 60, 70 to 1, as was the case with J.P. Morgan Chase. So the margin rules now are going to change so that, A, they have to put up more money to do the transaction, and B, their collateral has to be verified before it can be accepted. So it's a huge change, and many suspect that it's going to cause these banks to unwind their margin positions. Now,
Than keep them and have to come up with the collateral. Yeah,
that's right.
That makes sense.
And I'll note here that many of the U.S. banks are closer to meeting these margin requirements than the foreign banks, especially banks in the Eurozone. And guess who's at the top of my list in that regard?
Deutsche Bank?
Deutsche Bank.
Deutsche Bank.
That's right.
Because they got a billion or trillion or whatever they got.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a time when J.P. Morgan Chase was on that list, but in the last 7 years or so, they've managed to unwind a lot of their derivatives positions, where I think they used to have $90 trillion on the books. Now it's substantially less. But there's several ratios that come into place here, and that Tier 1 capital is very important. The amount of money that the individuals that own the bank and the bank itself in the form of stockholders has in capital, in liquid capital. And their ability to meet these ratios required, where you can't get leverage now 70 to 1 or 100 to 1. And the sense is that this will reduce risk in the overall marketplace. I think it'll cause more problems than it'll solve. And it's just one of the series of convergences that are occurring this fall that really make it for an unsure monetary environment.
An unsure monetary, can we coach on that? Unsure monetary environment. Okay, we're going to do a quick little break, and then Andrew's going to give you some ideas of what you can do with whatever, wherever you are in your life, some ideas of what you can do to protect yourself. And the problem is, you listen to one radio network, you're going to live a long time, and then you could outlive your money, and that's not good. So we'll talk about that. She's Andra.
Know the Source on One Radio Network.
Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
Okay, I am Richard Massey, and Meridian Grace will be here tomorrow. They're great. We'll have a lot of fun. If you have questions about your health, these folks are in the trenches every day with people. Meridian Grace does massive amounts of research. So if you got some health questions, come on by tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, live Central Time with Dr. Richard Massey and Meridian Grace. Get your emails in any time and we'll stack them up. We'll stack them up. We're going to get to some things that you can do to protect yourself after one other email here. If the Federal Reserve System, writes an emailer, wanted to bail out the students and not the banks with a QE for students, what would the balance sheet look like?
Well, there would have to be corresponding loans. So the
there's a trillion or so, right, Andrew?
Yeah.
1.3.
So the Federal Reserve Bank could buy from the financial institutions the $1 trillion in student loan debt, and then they create the $1 trillion to buy it from these agencies, and then put the $1 trillion in bonds or notes, IOUs, in the vault, along with the mortgage-backed securities.
On their balance sheet.
Already in there,
that's
right?
That's how they do.
And then they can either put all the students on a favorable repayment schedule, or they can simply collect from those that can pay and ignore those that can't, which gives us the moral hazard issue.
So. Yes. So can a candidate, either a Trump or a Clinton, come out a week before the election and say, you know, we're just going to do this. We're going to take care of all you kids. Would they have the power in office to make a phone call and just do it?
No.
Because?
Well, as many people tout the independence of the Federal Reserve.
They are private.
They are independent of influence from the president and from political machinations.
Supposedly.
Supposedly.
Theoretically. So they couldn't do that now.
No. That's not to say that the president couldn't
do a deal,
mm-hmm. or announce some fiscal policy that would do the same thing, some sort of debt forgiveness or some sort of government guarantee where the government simply makes up the student loan payments of every person with a student loan. What that would cost in any given year, while it's true it's a $1 trillion total debt, like any student would pay it, you pay a little bit each month. So if a little bit each month came out of the Treasury and went to the various owners of these notes, alleviating the burden upon the students, that would be a brilliant political ploy, that's for sure.
It seems to me, looking at some numbers, Andrew Goss, that the people that really benefited from this student loan thing, that I don't, how long is it? Is it 10 years, 20 years?
Like that.
Yeah. Were the colleges, universities, they just
Absolutely.
Kept raising their prices.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Because the kids didn't really have to pay.
They didn't have to just take
out a loan.
Yeah, just to pay.
So they beefed up their endowments. They started paying their professors big money.
You think?
And these jobs were handed out as political favors. I mean, look at Elizabeth Warren up there at Harvard. You know, she gets $400,000 a year for teaching one class a week.
Really?
Yeah.
Who's the guy that just left Texas A&M because of a scandal? What was his name? You'd recognize him. You'd recognize him.
Yeah.
Anyway. he was just some political hack, and then they just make him president of the college. What was the guy's name?
Right.
Because he didn't take care of this people. These kids were getting shot down there.
Well, Larry Summers was made the president of Harvard.
Yeah.
So these institutions hand out political favors, both in staff and administration. So we need to reform that, that's for sure.
Yeah, I wish I could remember this guy's name, but I'll come up with it. The rest of this email. Is the Fed bank creating new reserves and giving them to the banks by buying the student loan debt? I think you covered that. And putting the student loans on the balance sheet of the Fed.
No.
The Fed tells all the students that their debt is no longer active and keeps the loans on the books forever. Is this legally possible?
Sure.
U.S. Title 12, Chapter 7, Subchapter, or whatever.
Yeah, it's completely legal.
Completely.
Yeah. It's the point that I made many times. Mm-hmm. You know, the Federal Reserve has $1.5 trillion or so in mortgage-backed securities in its vaults. And some people are paying their mortgages and some are not. And so the rate of return is variable, flexible, whatever you want to call it. But the Fed doesn't care. It's already issued $1.5 trillion and put it into circulation. So as time goes by, that money will simply be diluted from the balance sheet, both in terms of repaid principal and in written off principal as well. So they could easily do it if they wanted to.
They can do anything they wanted to.
That's right.
Okay, to wrap it up then for today, give some folks just some overall big picture ideas listening around the world. They hear this money show once a week and they really see and understand that things are a bit cattywampus, big picture, some just down-to-earth things that they could start thinking about with their family, themselves, their kids, to have the best shot at weathering whatever may happen financially in the next 5-10 years.
Yeah, and until you know who's going to be sitting in the White House, it's almost impossible to plan accordingly.
Oh, good.
Understand that both candidates will be dealing with very serious economic issues, and that one, the Republican Donald Trump, will probably reduce taxes and increase productivity as a means of dealing with this problem, whereas the other, the Democrat, Hillary Clinton, will probably raise taxes and increase government spending to deal with the circumstance. So I would think we would get a much more inflationary climate under Hillary Clinton, and while we would get less inflation under Donald Trump, more risk of a recession. So it's hard to plan for everything, and I know it's like don't ask a barber if you need a haircut, but I've found the perfect asset in rare American gold and silver coins. And to me, I'm very comfortable having the bulk of my wealth associated with this market. And so regardless of what happens or who is elected, I know that my gold and silver coins fundamentally have every reason to increase in value. A fixed supply and increasing demand and an increasing supply of dollars, all three combine to provide an excellent opportunity. So if you haven't bought any coins or learned anything about how that market works, I would urge you to call our 800 number and ask for the audio CD, Protecting Your Wealth. It will explain the ins and outs of the gold and silver coin market and how you can participate.
And what are your thoughts on talking to your kids right now who are teenagers and even yourself who's 30, 40, 50, a lot of working years ahead? What are your thoughts on things that people can think about to give them some hedge against the falling dollar, which we believe is going to happen, right?
Yeah, get the means of production in place as soon as possible. So there's one English lord, doggone it, he was, you know, in his 60s, and he wanted a tree planted along his driveway that would have taken 30 years to grow. And so he says to the groundskeeper, you know, how much should I hurry up and plant that tree? And the groundskeeper says, what the heck is the difference? We're not going to see its results for 30 years. He's like, well, that's why we want to do it right now. So the more you plan for that future that is inevitable, you know, put in the means of production now, you make those investments now rather than waiting. You know, that it is a sad fact of life that people don't plan for their retirement until they're nearing their retirement. This is something that you can instill in the kids that you need to do from the first day of your working life, the 10% that's never lent and never spent and always saved. And for me, again, the savings vehicle is the gold and silver coin provided by the Treasury. So if you store your wealth from the first day that you save it in this form, then you'll find as time goes on that it serves you quite well in protecting you against inflation, recession, depression, and it always serves as an excess or emergency store of capital if and when you desperately need it.
Boy, I look back and, you know, when I got out of the service in the late 60s.
Right.
And if you really would have done that.
Yes.
Said, okay, whatever I make, I'm going to just take 10%.
That's it.
And I'm going to just...
Save it.
I'm going to save it, and maybe I'd be smart enough to buy some just coins to put it in.
The two have to go together.
Real money rather than dollars.
You have to preserve.
Could you imagine what that would be amassed in the last, 40, 50 years for Patrick or other people? Or if you could really, because you know what? You think back, and if you took 10% right off the top of whatever you were making, you know, I was working at McDonald's, anything, right? At the beginning, or a radio station when I got out of the service, I know I could have survived and saved 10%.
Mm-hmm.
I know I could have.
Sure.
Thinking back, I mean, at the time, you don't even think about it, right? You just spend it all.
Yeah.
But boy, if you could somehow
save it
and instill into a grandchild or a child, how powerful that would be. Man, I don't think there's a better thing you could do for your kid.
No, stacking silver dollars.
Yeah, silver bucks, man. Silver dollars and stack them up.
Yep.
And just don't spend them.
Nope. No matter what.
No matter what. Wow.
Yeah.
And it could be done, too, couldn't it, Andrew? I mean, it could really be done.
I highlight the case of the Kodak engineer. You know, we have Kodak right down the street here. And John J. Pittman was an engineer over there. And he just took all of his excess money. His wife describes how they didn't go on vacation and so forth. Because he was saving money and buying gold and silver coins.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1949, he spent $1,503, hard-earned.
That was a lot of money.
No question. It was a lot of money. And he bought the silver components of this 1859 proof set.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was the dollar, the half, the quarter, the dime, the nickel, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he passed on in 1996. So... what is that, 47 years or so?
Mm-hmm.
And then his wife auctioned off these coins, and that portion brought $425,000.
$1,400.
$1,503.
Wow.
Yeah, brought $425,000 in 1997 money. So, and this speaks a little bit to the rarity of the coins he put away, but it speaks more to the purchasing power of the dollar. You know, what he had... put away as in terms of purchasing power at $1,500 in 1949, I mean, arguably, that was a couple hundred thousand dollars if it would have just kept pace with the ravaging inflation that went on during that period.
Mm-hmm.
So combination of the two, however, protecting yourself against the inflation and buying something that will rise in excess of inflation, I think that was the brilliance of John J. Pittman. And his estate, which was built, again, by a working person who was aggressive in their savings, brought his widow nearly $8 million some 50 years later.
I'll be darned.
So it is possible to do. It requires discipline, and it requires resisting the urge to dip in, so to speak. You know, I'm going to go ahead and sell these coins and buy myself whatever.
Plus, if you did have a real emergency and there was the only way, you'd still have something to
dip
in, too.
Oh, indeed.
It wouldn't be like a catastrophe if
you
spent whatever.
It is a perfect emergency savings. You know, if you're one of those folks that defines an emergency as something really harsh and it doesn't happen to you and your wealth is stored, that emergency wealth is stored in gold and silver coin, very liquid, I would add.
Sure. Very liquid.
Oh, goodness, you'll be.
And the cool thing about it is, even if a kid is babysitting or whatever, and they do that 10%, they can literally go to a coin shop, in their city,
yeah,
and they can buy silver dollars.
Silver dollars.
I mean, and even if they've got $5 to spend,
that's right,
or whatever, they can buy something.
That's right.
They can buy. They that's can pretty buy. Cool.
Yeah.
And because these pre-65, is it 65?
Pre-65 in the quarters, yeah, dimes, and halves, and pre-35 in the silver dollars.
Which was real silver.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It meets the standard of a dollar. In fact, the Statue of Liberty silver dollar and the Constitution silver dollar, the ones that were especially struck when Ronald Reagan took office in 85, 86, 87, 88, like that.
Yeah.
Those are just coming into their own today. You know, it's been a significant period since they were issued new, and you can buy them today in the secondary market at just a small premium over their actual silver content, and for me, those represent an outstanding buy moving forward. I think they will only become more rare.
Do you sell large quantities of these pre-65 coins to people?
Indeed we do.
Rather than, I mean, like bags of them? Didn't you used to have bags of them?
Bags and bags and bags and bags and bags.
And what's it called? Currency it's silver?
Coin silver.
Coin silver.
Yeah, it's 900 fine. And it generally sells at a multiple of its face value. So anywhere from 17 to 20 times its face value, let's say, at $20 or so silver. And, you know, you buy as much as you can afford. So for some people, that means a couple of $100. And for some people, that might mean a couple of $1 million. Whatever it is, as I try to caution folks in the larger figures, you know, where are you going to store the bodies?
That's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot.
It's just a lot of stuff. Weight.
But why would you do that? I'm curious. Why would you do that if you had like a bunch of money, whatever, $50,000, rather than just buy some nice coins? What would be the rationale?
You know? Well, in terms of liquidity, so let's say that you took and bought one $50,000 coin instead of $50,000 worth of silver dollars.
Right.
Well, your option when the time comes is to sell that $50,000 coin. You can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So if you got to sell it, you might not be a good time to sell.
That's absolutely right.
Right.
And so you're forced to sell that coin and now be stuck with that pile of money. Whereas if you only needed $2,000, you could take a portion of those silver dollars and sell until you got your $2,000.
That's really liquid.
It is really liquid, and in the amount that you might need. If you need all the money, you sell them all. But if you only need a little bit of the money, you sell just a little bit. And the nice thing about it is, as the price increases, so let's say you buy 1,000 silver dollars at $25 each, that's $25,000. And then they rise to $50,000, and you decide you're going to take your principal out, well, you sell half of them. Now you have the other half for free. So you can't, again, do that with a single $50,000 coin. And generally speaking, if somebody's going to buy a $50,000 coin from me, it means they have $250,000 worth of this silver and gold that's very liquid and easy to buy or sell.
So what's cool about fiat currency is it goes the other way. I mean, there are ways that you can trade these pieces of paper with pictures of dead presidents that are dead instruments for real money.
You don't have to store them.
I mean, that's
kind
of fun.
You don't have to store them.
You don't have to
store them. That's the key. So I understand.
Oh, you don't have to store the Federal Reserve notes.
Correct. Yeah. I understand that you have to work for them. You price your goods in them. You buy them. You sell them, essentially.
Buy coffee with them or whatever.
Right. But you don't have to build huge accounts of them. You don't have to be a shareholder in the Federal Reserve system, and that's effectively what people do instead. So if you convert it immediately, you get a bunch of dollars, you convert immediately to gold and silver, and then you go get some more dollars, and you convert again to gold and silver coin. Eventually, you're building a pile that will outperform or outproduce the fiat money. And you can always trade your gold and silver coin for paper money. But I don't know that you'll always be able to trade your paper money for gold and silver coins. So you really,
why? Because of availability, price? Whatever,
exactly.
If things go really
and acceptability. Yeah. If people say,
what do you mean acceptability?
Acceptability. No, all you have are dollars. I don't want those.
Oh, I see.
Convert them
I want those dollars.
Yeah. I don't know. So you can't foretell the future when it comes to the value of fiat money, and whether it's going to hold together or whether it'll do what the collapsitarians suggest and fall into a heap. But one thing is certain, that never would happen to gold and silver coin. It cannot conceivably lose all of its value.
Because?
supply and demand.
There's only so much,
right? And there's absolutely no counterparty risk, and the value of the silver dollar kind of travels with the silver dollar. It is the full-bodied nature of its metal content. You know, a $20 gold piece still contains nearly an ounce of gold, and so that's what gives it its value, not any government edict or fiat.
So it's a real clear explanation of where you're coming from philosophically as a business guy, because you learned about this monetary system years ago, 40 years ago,
yeah, exactly.
And you saw how it really worked. Right. And then you got into the business.
Sure.
I mean, you found the best investment thing that you know.
Yeah, if there was something better. Exactly. I have said it many times. If there was something better, I would do that instead. You know, those old silver dollars that I bought at the beginning of my career for $4 and $4.50.
Yeah.
You know, they're $30-$40 now.
Wow.
So, and that will be true for the next 40 years as we move forward in this. I think that any silver dollars purchased today, you fast forward 40 years, you'll see that same type of growth. It is inevitable, just as sure as governments will inflate their currency. And as long as that's the case, then the only protection is gold and silver coin. That's why our forefathers gave it to us.
And it's inevitable because, as you said, the powers that be that have the magic checkbook, the central banks, they're not likely to change their view on how they control things anytime soon.
Yeah,
I mean, let's just be real about it. Right.
The odds of them issuing a gold bond or going back to a gold-backed currency, which would, quite frankly, just put me right out of business, and I would gladly go out of business if you knew that your dollar was so much gold or so much silver and you could just store them and know that you could always exchange them for so much gold or so much
silver. But that's not happening.
I don't see that happening in my lifetime. And if it happens, it's going to be because...
But there could be this flying saucer that comes down with a beam of light,
right.
And then enlighten them all.
Yeah, right. Or we could have an economic collapse of such proportions that no one would ever trust anything again other than gold and silver coin. And that takes.
But that's not really likely, is it?
Well, but it's possible.
I guess it's possible.
Yeah. Either way, people could get a sense that this is the only sure way to protect your wealth again. Whereas they had that feeling 150 years ago, and why they're so comfortable with electronic money today is beyond me.
Yeah. Well, this is a bit off subject, but I just want to end with this. You know, I've been reading so many of these big insurance companies are getting out of Obamacare. This thing, as you predicted, as many other people, is a disaster. It's a disaster.
Yeah.
But what I'm really concerned about is there most Americans, they don't understand what's going on in the world of their health,
Right.
They don't get it. And if they change jobs. A friend was telling me a story. They actually will pick a job that they hate because they're on depression medicine that they have to have insurance because they're depressed about the job. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
A vicious circle.
It is just really... I don't know how this is going to end. I just don't see how people who aren't taking care of themselves are going to be able... I don't know how they're going to end up. They'll be in nursing homes or something, or the government will ended up supporting them, right?
Keeping them
alive.
Yeah, somebody will have to because...
It's a tragedy.
This is the crisis of things that, only 3 people in 10 will reach retirement age with the means to be self-sufficient.
So what's that, other, 3 people?
3 in 10.
Wow.
Yeah. The other 7... will be totally reliant upon their Social Security and their Medicare and Medicaid and so forth.
Yeah. Well, finally, there was a poll taken, just released. 3 out of 5 people in Texas who support Donald Trump say they would support seceding from the Union if Hillary Clinton gets elected. So I thought I would just pass that along to
you. Yeah.
3 out of 5, that's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
What do you think
would
be up in Jersey?
Yeah. Yeah. Not a chance.
You guys are really, really...
It's a blue state.
It's
here.
A blue, man. You guys are blue, blue. Blue, 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 blue. You're blue. Well, kid, thanks. It was fun this morning. Covered a lot of territory.
What's up
with you guys? What's happening at SDL?
Oh, we're filtering out the auction lots. We had the 2 big auctions sorting everything, sending them off to the grading service, and making them available generally. So that's my function for the next 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm. You got product to sell? People want to buy it?
Well, it's raw. It needs to be certified. So it needs to, before I offer it to my clients, I send it to NGC and have it certified as to its grade and condition.
And they put them in the little containers?
So until that's done, I can't offer anything because, well, I could be wrong. It could grade lower or even higher than I thought that it would.
Mm-hmm.
So once that's done, then the feeding frenzy begins as the brokers start calling all of their best customers and saying, this is what I have. And
what do you think? You want some?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So generally people that have been in the gold numismatic business, your long-term customers, do they generally just keep buying?
Yeah, they're accumulating. As I've, you know,
these people that understand this,
right?
This whole game.
We don't speculate. We don't. Oh, gold is down $10, so let's buy.
Right.
Or gold is up $10, let's sell.
No.
It's rather let's accumulate over 10, 20, 50, who knows? You know, 15 years.
Who knows?
You accumulate, and then at the end of the accumulation phase, you divest yourself the same way that you bought it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't sell the whole pile at once, but rather you need some extra money. You sell one, you need a little more extra money, you sell the other. And this enables coin collections and accumulations to last 30 to 50 years. You know, you spend 15 to 25 accumulating and then 15 to 25, getting rid of them. At the end, you've had a wonderful run, and you've made maximum use of your money.
And you've had clients for, some clients, 20 years?
Some clients are intergenerational, where I'm now dealing with
sons
and grandsons and granddaughters
that's
and daughters.
Cool.
That is the fun part of the job, yep.
If you'd like to talk to Andrew up there, 800-468-2646, 800-468-2646.
I would just urge my customers to make one of their kids the decision maker because
it can get messy.
It is messy, I must say. When you're on the third generation,
well, I want to sell that coin
and
go to the Bahamas.
You're dealing with eight grandkids, So either divide the coins or make one of those children responsible. But don't make it a committee. My goodness, it's very difficult.
Can you actually do that legally?
Of course you
can. Say George is in charge here?
And many of my bigger clients have done exactly that. Ah. They've formed a trust and put the coins in trust and then made the children beneficiaries and one child is in charge. A couple have done it with the LLP, limited partnership route, and a couple have done it with straight corporations, where the corporation owns other assets. But the one thing that makes them work well is when one person is in charge. When it is a committee, you know, I have to talk to six or eight people and then get a consensus before we can do anything. That tends to make it much more cumbersome.
Yeah, I mean, you get six people together, there's no way you can even decide on what movie and where you're going to go for dinner.
Right. It is
it's
hard to get
It's not
going to
happen. No,
yeah,
it's not going to happen. All right, Phil, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Patrick.
Timpone, Andrew Goss, good friend and knows his stuff. Hope you enjoyed the show this morning. Got the dog days of going on. Most of the boys are, essentially Martha's Vineyard playing golf with things are going to spice up here as far as things to talk about in the coming weeks, we believe. So join us on The Real World of Money every Wednesday with currency historian Andrew Goss. Tomorrow, Richard Massey, Meridian Grace. We're going to have fun, so be here or be square. We will see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.